Chapter 6. Passing the gauntlet of the steely eyes of the lobby sentinel, mounting in the private elevator, and using my key in the 10th floor vestibule, I found that the electronic security apparatus hadn't been switched on yet. Steck appeared, of course, and said that Mr. Gerald would like to see me in the library. The eye I gave him was a different eye from what it had been. It could even have been Steck who had worked the rug trick to get hold of a gun. He had his duties, but he might have managed to squeeze it in. Hearing voices in the lounge, I crossed the reception hall to glance in, and saw Trella, Nora, and Roger Foote at a card table. Roger looked up and called to me. "Pinochle, come and take a hand." "Sorry, I can't. Mr. Gerald wants me." "Come when you're through. Peach Fuzz ran a beautiful race. Beautiful. 5 lengths back at the turn and only a head behind at the finish. Beautiful." A really fine loser, I was thinking as I headed for the corridor. You don't often meet that kind of sporting spirit. Beautiful. The door of the library was standing open. Entering, I closed it. Gerald, over by the files with one of the drawers open, barked at me, "Be with you in a minute." And I went to the chair at an end of his desk. A Portanaga with an inch of ash intact was there on a tray, and the smell told me it was still alive. So it couldn't have been more than 90 seconds since he left his desk to go to the files. That's the advantage of being a detective with a trained mind. You collect all kinds of useless facts without even trying. He came and sat, picked up the cigar and tapped the ash off, and took a couple of puffs. He spoke. "Why did you go to see Wolf?" "He pays my salary. He likes to know what he's getting for it. Also, I had told him on the phone about your gun disappearing, and he wanted to ask me about it."
"Did you have to tell him about that?"
"I thought I'd better. You're his client, and he doesn't like to have his client shot. And if somebody used the gun to kill you with, and I hadn't told him about it, he would have been annoyed. Besides, I thought he might want to make a suggestion."
"Did he make one?"
"Not a suggestion, exactly. He made a comment. He said you're an ass. He said you should have corralled everybody and got the cops in to find the gun."
"Did you tell him I'm convinced that my daughter-in-law took it?"
"Sure. But even if she did, and if she intends to use it on you, that would still be the best way to handle it. It would get the gun back, and it would notify her that you haven't got a hole in your head and don't intend to have one." He showed no reaction to my mentioning a hole in the head. "It was you who said we'd probably find it in a tub on the terrace." "I didn't say probably, but what if I did?" "We'd have the gun. You said on the phone you've got instructions for me about looking for it."
"No, not that."
He took a pull on the cigar, removed it, and let the smoke float out. "I don't remember just how much I've told you about Corey Brigham."
"Not much. No details.
That he's an old friend of yours. No, you didn't use the word friend. That he got in ahead of you on a deal, and that you think your daughter-in-law was responsible. I've been a little surprised to see him around."
"I want him around. I want him to think I've accepted his explanation and I don't suspect anything. The deal was about a shipping company. I found out about a claim that could be made against it, and I was all set to buy the claim and then put the screws on. And when I was ready to close in, I found that Brigham was there ahead of me. He said he had got next to it through somebody else, that he didn't know I was after it, but he's a damn liar. There wasn't anybody else. The only source was mine, and I had it clamped tight. He got it through information that was in this room, and he got it from my daughter-in-law."
"That raises questions," I told him. "I don't have to ask why Susan gave it to him, because I already know your answer to that. She gives things to men, including her, favors, because that's what she's like."
"But how did she get it?"
"She got my gun yesterday, didn't she?"
"I don't know, and neither do you. Anyhow, how many times has that rug walked in here?"
"Not any. That was a new one. But she knows how to find a way to get anything she wants. She could have got it from Jim Eber. Or from my son. Or she could have been in here with my son when Nora and I weren't here, and sent him out for something and got it herself.
God only knows what else she got. Most of my operations are based on some kind of inside information, and a lot of it is on paper. It has to be. And I'm afraid to leave anything important in here anymore. God damn it, she has to go!
He pulled out the cigar, found it was out, and dropped it in the tray.
There's another aspect. I stood to clear $1 million on that deal, probably more. So Brigham did instead of me, and she got her share of it. She gives things to men, including her favors, if you want to call it that. But all the time, her main object is herself. She got her share. That's what I've got instructions about. See if you can find it. She's got it salted away somewhere, and maybe you can find it. Maybe you can get a lead to it through Brigham. Get next to him. He's a goddamn snob, but he won't be snooty to my secretary if you handle it right. Another possibility is Jim Eber. Get next to him, too. You met him yesterday. I don't know just what your approach will be, but you should be able to work that out yourself. And don't forget our deal, yours and mine. $10,000 the day she's out of here, with my son staying, and $50,000 more when the divorce papers are signed. I had been wondering if he had forgotten about that. I was also wondering if he figured that later, remembering that he told me Thursday night to get next to Jim Eber, I would regard that as evidence that he hadn't been aware that Eber was no longer approachable. I reminded him that it takes two to make a deal and that I hadn't accepted his offer, but he waved that away as not worth discussing. His suggestion that I cultivate Eber made it relevant for me to ask questions about him, and I did so. But while some of the answers I got might have been helpful for getting to know him better, none of them shed any light on the most important fact about him, that he was dead. He had been with Gerald 5 years, was unmarried, was a Presbyterian but didn't work at it, played golf on Sunday, was fair to good at bridge, and so on. I also collected some data on Corey Brigham. When Gerald finished with me and I went, leaving him at his desk, I stood outside for a moment, on the rug that walked like a man, or a woman, debating whether to go and join the Pinochle Players, to observe them from the new angle I now had on the whole bunch, or to go for a walk and call Wolf to tell him what Gerald's instructions had been. It was a draw, so I decided to do neither and went upstairs to bed. I slept all right, I always sleep, but woke up at 7 o'clock. I turned over and shut my eyes again, but nothing doing. I was awake. It was a damn nuisance. I would have liked to get up and dress and go down to the studio and hear the 8 o'clock news. It had been exactly 10:30 when I had phoned headquarters to tell them, in falsetto, that they had better take a look at a certain apartment at a certain number on 49th Street. And by now the news would be out and I wanted to hear it. But on Tuesday I had appeared for breakfast at 9:25, on Wednesday at 10:15, and on Thursday at 9:20. And if I shattered precedent by showing before 8, making for the radio, and announcing what I had heard to anyone available, and it would be remarkable not to announce it, someone might have wondered how come. So when my eyes wouldn't stay closed, no matter which side I tried, I lay on my back and let them stay open, hoping they liked the ceiling. They didn't. They kept turning. Up, down, right, left. I got the impression that they were trying to turn clear over to see inside. When I found myself wondering what would happen if they actually made it, I decided that had gone far enough, kicked the sheet off, and got up. I took my time in the shower and shaving and putting cufflinks in a clean shirt and other details, and history repeated itself. I was pulling on my pants, getting the second leg through, when there was a knock at the door. And nothing timid about it. I called out, "Who is it?" And for reply, the door opened and Gerald walked in. I spoke. "Good morning. Come sometime when I've got my shoes on." He had closed the door. "This can't wait. Jim Eber is dead. They found his body in his apartment. Murdered. Shot." I stared, not overdoing it. "For God's sake, when?" "I got it on the radio, the 8 o'clock news. They found him last night. He was shot in the head, in the back. That's all it said. It didn't mention that he worked for me." He went to a chair, the big one by the window, and sat. I want to discuss it with you." I had put my shoes and clean socks by that chair, intending to sit there to put them on. Going to get them, taking another chair, pulling my pants leg up and starting a sock on, I said, "If they don't already know he worked for you, they soon will. You realize that?" "Certainly I realize it. They may phone or come any minute. That's what I want to discuss." I picked up the other sock. "All right, discuss. Shoot." "You know what a murder investigation is like, Goodwin. You know that better than I do." "Yeah, it's no fun." "It certainly isn't. Of course, they may already have a line on somebody. They may even have the man that did it. There was nothing on the radio about that. But if they haven't, and if they don't get him soon, you know what it will be like. They'll dig everywhere as deep as they can. He was with me 5 years, and he lived here. They'll want to know everything about him, and it's mostly here they'll expect to get it." I was tying a shoelace. "Yeah, they have no respect for privacy when it's murder." He nodded. "I know they haven't. And I know the best way to handle it is to tell them anything they want to know, within reason. If they think I'm holding out, that will only make it worse. I appreciate that. One thing I want to discuss with you, they'll ask why I fired Eber, and what do I say?" I had my shoes on now and was on equal terms. Conferring in bare feet with a man who is properly shod may not put you at a disadvantage, but it seems to. It may be because he could step on your toes. With mine now protected, I said, "Just tell them why you fired him, that you suspected him of leaking business secrets." He shook his head. "If I do that, they'll want details. What secrets he leaked and who to, all that. That would take them onto ground where I don't want them. I would rather tell them that Eber was getting careless. He seemed to be losing interest, and I decided to let him go. No matter who else they ask, nobody could contradict that, not even Nora, except one person. You. If they ask you, you can simply say that you don't know much about it, that you understand that I was dissatisfied with Eber, but you don't know why, can't you?" I was frowning at him. "This must have given you quite a jolt, Mr. Jarrell. You'd better snap out of it. Two of Mr. Wolfe's oldest and dearest enemies, and mine, are Inspector Kramer and Sergeant Stebbins of Homicide. The minute they catch sight of me and learn that I'm here under another name in Eber's job, the sparks will start flying. No matter what reason you give them for firing him, they won't believe you. They won't believe me. They won't believe anybody. The theory they'll like best will be that you decided that Eber had to be shot and got me in as a technical consultant. That may be stretching it a little, but it gives you an idea." "Good God." He was stunned. "Of course. So I can't simply say I don't know much about it." "Good God, no. My mind wasn't working." He leaned forward at me. "Look, Goodwin, the other thing I was going to ask you to say nothing about what happened Wednesday, about my gun being taken. I'm not afraid that gun was used to shoot Eber. That's not it. It may not have been that caliber. But when they come here on a murder investigation, you know how it will be if they find out that my gun was stolen just the day before. And if it was that caliber, it will be 100 times worse. So I was going to ask you not to mention it. Nobody else knows about it. Horland's man doesn't. He left before I found it was gone." "I told you, I told Mr. Wolfe." "They don't have to get to Wolfe." "Maybe they don't have to, but they will as soon as they see me. I'll tell you, Mr. Jarrell, it seems to me you're still jolted. You're not thinking straight. The way you feel about your daughter-in-law, this may be right in your lap. You want to sink her so bad you can taste it. You hired Mr. Wolfe and gave him $10,000 for a retainer, and then offered me another $60,000. If you tell Inspector Kramer all about it, only Kramer, not Stebbins or Rocliffe or any of his gang, and not some squirt of an assistant district attorney, and tell him about the gun, and he starts digging at it and comes up with proof that Susan shot Eber, what better could you ask? You said you knew Susan took the gun, and if so, she wanted to use it on someone, and why not Eber? And if you're afraid Kramer might botch it, keep Mr. Wolfe on the job. He loves to see to it that Kramer doesn't botch something." "No," he said positively. "Why not? You'll soon know if Eber was shot with a .38. I can find out about that for you within an hour, as soon as I get some breakfast. Why not?
I won't have them. I won't do it. No. You know damn well I won't. I won't tell the police about my personal affairs and have them spread all over. I don't want you or Wolf telling them either. I see now that my idea wouldn't work, that if they find out you're here in Eber's place, there'll be hell to pay. So they won't find out. You won't be here, and you'd better leave right now because they might come any minute. If they want to know where my new secretary is, I'll take care of that. He has only been here 4 days and knew nothing about Eber. You'd better leave now.
And go where?
Where you belong, damn it. He gestured a hand out. You'll have to make allowances for me, Goodwin. I've had a jolt. Certainly I have. If you're not here, and if I account for the absence of my new secretary, they'll never get to you or Wolf either. Tell Wolf I'm still his client, and I'll get in touch with him. He said he was discreet. Tell him there's no limit to what his discretion may be worth to me. He left the chair. As for you, no limit with you, too. I'm a tough operator, but I pay for what I get. Go on, get your necktie on. Leave your stuff here, that won't matter, you can get it later. We understand each other, don't we?
If we don't, we will.
I like you, Goodwin. Get going.
I moved. He stood and watched me while I got my tie and jacket on, gathered a few items and put them in the small bag and closed the bag. When I glanced back as I turned the corner at the end of the hall, he was standing in front of the door to my room. I was disappointed not to see Steck in the corridor or reception hall. He must have had morning duties somewhere. Outside, I crossed the avenue, flagged a taxi headed downtown, and at 9:15 was mounting the stoop of the old brownstone. Wolf would be up in the plant rooms for his morning session, from 9 to 11, with the orchids. The chain bolt was on, so I had to ring, and it was Ori Cather who opened up. He extended a hand.
"Take your bag, sir?"
I let him take it, strode down the hall to the kitchen, and pushed the door. Fritz, at the sink, turned.
"Archie, a pleasure. You're back?"
"I'm back for breakfast, anyhow. My God, I'm empty. No orange juice, even. 1 dozen pancakes, please." I did eat 7. Chapter 7. I was in the office, refreshed and refueled, in time to get the 10 o'clock news. It didn't add much to what Gerald had heard 2 hours earlier, and nothing that I didn't already know. Ori, at ease on the couch, inquired,
"Did it help any?"
"I'm ignorant, so I have to ask. What's hot? The budget?"
"Yeah, I'm underwriting it.
I'm also writing a book on criminology and researching it. Excuse me, I'm busy." I dialed a number I didn't have to look up, the Gazette, asked for Lon Cohen's extension, and in a minute had him.
"Lon, Archie, I'm busy."
"So am I. I'm collecting data for a book."
"What did you shoot James L. Eber with, an arquebus?"
"No, my arquebus is in hock. I used a flintlock. What is it to you?"
"I'm just curious. If you'll satisfy my curiosity, I'll satisfy yours someday."
"Have they found the bullet?"
"Lon is a fine guy and a good poker player, but he has the occupational disease of all journalists. Before he'll answer a question, he has to ask one. So he did."
"Has Wolf got a thumb in it already?"
"Not a thumb, a foot."
"No, he hasn't, not for the record. If and when, you first, as usual."
"Have they found the bullet?"
"Yes, it just came in. A .38, that's all so far."
"Who is Wolf's client?"
"J. Edgar Hoover."
"Have they arrested anybody?"
"No. My God, give them time to sweep up and sit down and think. It was only 12 hours ago. I've been thinking ever since I heard your voice just now. What I think it was you who called headquarters last night and told them to go and look, and I'm sore. You should have called me first."
"I should, at that. Next time."
"Have they or you or anyone got any kind of a lead?"
"To the murderer, no. So far, the most interesting item is that up to a couple of weeks ago, he was working for a guy named Otis Gerald. You know who he is."
"By God, it was him you phoned me the other day to get dope on."
"Sure it was. That's one reason. Is Gerald Wolf's client?"
"For the present, as far as you're concerned, Wolf has no client. I was saying that's one reason I'm calling now. I thought you might remember I had asked about him. and I want to tell you not to trust your memory until further notice. Just go ahead and gather the news and serve the public. You may possibly hear from me someday.
Come on up here. I'll buy you a lunch. I can't make it, Lon, sorry. Don't use any wooden bullets.
As I pushed the phone back, Ori asked, "What's an arquebus?"
"Figure it out yourself. A combination of an ark and a bus. Amphibian."
"Then don't." He sat up. "If I'm not supposed to be in on whatever you think you're doing, okay, but I have a right to know what an arquebus is. Do you want me out of here?"
I told him no, I could think better with him there for contrast.
Body got bounced when Wolf came down at 11 o'clock. From the kitchen, I had buzzed the plant rooms on the house phone to tell him I was there, so he wasn't surprised to see me. He went to his desk, glanced at the morning mail, which was skimpy, straightened his desk blotter, and focused on me.
"Well?"
"In my opinion," I said, "the time has come for a complete report." His eyes went over my shoulder to the couch.
"If we need you on this, Ori, you will get all the required information. That can wait."
"Yes, sir." Ori got up and went. When the door had closed behind him, I spoke. "I called Lon Cohen. The bullet that killed Eber is a .38. Gerald didn't know that when he entered my room this morning, knocking but not waiting for an invitation. He only knew what he had heard on the radio at 8 o'clock, and I suppose you heard it too. Even so, he badly needed a tranquilizer. When I report in full, you'll know what he said. It ended with his telling me to beat it quick before the cops arrived. He said to tell you he's still your client and he'll get in touch with you, and there's no limit to what your discretion may be worth to him. Me too. My discretion is as good as yours. Now that I know it was a .38, I have only two alternatives. Either I go down to homicide and open the bag, or I give you the whole works from the beginning, words and music, and you listen, and then put your mind on it. If I get tossed in the coop for withholding evidence, you can't operate anyhow, with me not here to supervise, so you might as well be with me."
"Phooey. As I said last night, there is no obligation to report what may be merely a coincidence."
He sighed.
"However, I concede that I'll have to listen. As for putting my mind on it, we'll see. Go ahead."
It took me 2 hours. I will not say that I gave him every word that had been pronounced in my hearing since Monday afternoon, 4 days back, but I came close to it. I left out some of Tuesday evening at Colonna's with Lois. Things that are said between dances when the band is good and your partner is better than good are apt to be irrelevant and off-key in a working detective's report. Aside from that, I didn't miss much, and nothing of any importance, and neither did he. If he listens at all, he listens. The only interruptions were the two bottles of beer he rang for, brought by Fritz, both, of course, for Wolf. The last half hour he was leaning back in his chair with his eyes closed, but that didn't mean he wasn't getting it. I stood up and stretched and sat down again. "So what it amounts to is that we are to sit it out, nothing to do but eat and sleep and name our figure."
"Not an intolerable lot, Archie. The figure you suggested last evening was 500,000.
"Yes, sir. I've decided that Billy Graham wouldn't approve. Say that the chance is 1 in 10 that one of them killed Eber. I think it's at least 50-50, but even if it's only 1 in 10, I pass. So do you. You have to. You know darned well it's one of two things. One is to call it off with Gerald, back clear out, and hand it over to Kramer. He would appreciate it." He made a face. His eyes opened.
"What's the other?"
"You go to work."
"At what? Investigating the murder of Mr. Eber? No one has hired me to."
I grinned at him. "No good. You call it quibbling, I call it dodging. The murder is in only because one of them might have done it with Gerald's gun. The question is, do we tell Kramer about the gun? We would rather not. The client would rather not. The only way out, if we're not going to tell Kramer, is to find out if one of them killed Eber. Not to satisfy a judge and jury, just to satisfy us. If they didn't, to hell with Kramer. If they did, we go on from there.
The only way to find out is for you to go to work, and the only way for you to get to work is for me to phone Gerald and tell him to have them here, all of them, at 6 o'clock today. What's wrong with that?
You would, he growled.
Yes, sir. Of course, there's a complication, me. To them, I'm Alan Green, so I can't be here as Archie Goodwin, but that's easy. Ori can be Archie Goodwin at my desk, and I'll be Alan Green. Since I was in on the discovery that the gun was gone, I should be present. I looked up at the wall clock. Lunch in 8 minutes. I should phone Gerald now. I made it slow motion, taking 10 seconds to swivel, pull the phone over, lift the receiver, and start dialing, to give him plenty of time to stop me. He didn't. How could he after my invincible logic? Nor did he move to take his phone. Then a voice was in my ear. Mr. Otis Gerald's office. It wasn't Nora, but a male, and I thought I knew what male. I said I was Alan Green and wanted to speak to Mr. Gerald, and in a moment had him. Yes, Green? I kept my voice down. Is anyone else on?
No.
You're sure?
Yes.
Was that Wyman answering?
Yes.
He's there in the office with you?
Yes.
Then you'd better let me do the talking and stick to yes and no. I'm here with Mr. Wolfe. Do you know that the bullet that killed Eber is a 38?
No.
Well, it is. Have you had any callers?
Yes.
Anything drastic?
No.
Ring me later and tell me about it if you want to. I'm calling for Mr. Wolfe. Now that we know it was a 38, he thinks I should tell the police about your gun. It could be a question of withholding evidence. He feels strongly about it, but he is willing to postpone it on one condition. The condition is that you have everybody in this office at 6 o'clock today so he can question them. By everybody, he means you, your wife, Wyman, Susan, Lois, Nora Kent, Roger Foote, and Corey Brigham. I'll be here as Alan Green, your secretary. Another man will be at my desk as Archie Goodwin.
I don't see how.
Hold it. I know you're biting nails, but hold it. You can tell them that Mr. Wolfe will explain why this conference is necessary, and he will. Have you told any of them about your gun being taken?
No.
Don't. He will. He'll explain that when you learned that Eber had been shot with a 38, that should be on the air by now, and it will be in the early afternoon papers, you were concerned, naturally, and you hired him to investigate, and he insisted on seeing all of you. I know you've got objections. You'll have to swallow them. But if you want help on it, get rid of Wyman and Nora and call me back. If you don't call me back, we'll be expecting you, all of you, here at 6 o'clock.
No, I'll call back.
Sure, glad to have you. I hung up, turned, and told Wolfe. You heard all of it except his no's and yes's. Satisfactory?
No,
he said. But that was just reflex. I'll say one thing for Wolfe. He hates to have anyone else's meal interrupted almost as much as his own. One of the standing rules in that house is that when we are at table and nothing really hot is on, Fritz answers the phone in the kitchen, and if it seems urgent, I go and get it. There may be something or somebody Wolfe would leave the table for, but I don't know what or who. That day Fritz was passing a platter of what Wolfe calls hedgehog omelet, which tastes a lot better than it sounds, when the phone rang, and I told Fritz not to bother and went to the office. It was Gerald calling back, and he had a lot of words besides yes and no. I permitted him to let off steam until it occurred to me that the omelet would be either cold or shriveled, and then told him firmly that it was either bring them or else. Back at the table, I found that the omelet had had no chance to either cool or shrivel, not with Ori there to help Wolfe with it. I did get a bite. We had just started on the avocado, whipped with sugar and lime juice and green chartreuse, when the doorbell rang. During meals, Fritz was supposed to get that too, but I thought Gerald might have rushed down to use more words face to face, so I got up and went to the hall for a look through the one-way glass panel in the front door. Having looked, I returned to the dining room and told Wolfe, "One's here already. The stenographer, Nora Kent." He swallowed avocado.
Nonsense, you said 6 o'clock.
Yes, sir, she must be on her own. The bell rang again. And she wants in. I aimed a thumb at Ori. Archie Goodwin here can take her to the office and shut the door.
Confound it.
He was going to have to work sooner than expected. To Ori,
you are Archie Goodwin.
Yes, sir, Ori said. It's a come down, but I'll try. Do I know her?
No, you have never seen or heard of her.
The bell rang again.
Take her to the office and come and finish your lunch.
He went. He closed the door, but the office was just across the hall, and it might startle her if she heard Alan Green's voice as she went by. So I used my mouth for an avocado depot only. Sounds came faintly, since the walls and doors on that floor are all soundproofed. When Ori entered, he shut the door, returned to his place, picked up his spoon, and spoke.
You didn't say to rub it in that I'm Archie Goodwin, and she didn't ask, so I didn't mention it. She said her name was Nora Kent, and she wants to see Mr. Wolfe. How long am I going to be Archie Goodwin?
I put in. Mr. Wolfe never talks business at the table, you know that, Ori. You haven't been told yet, but you were going to be me at a party later on, and now you can practice. Just sit at my desk and look astute. I'll have my eye on you. I'll be at the hole, unless Mr. Wolfe has other plans.
No, Wolfe muttered. I have no plans.
The hole, 10 inches square, was at eye level in the wall, 12 feet to the right of Wolfe's desk. On the office side, it was covered by what appeared to be just a pretty picture of a waterfall. On the other side, in a wing of the hall across from the kitchen, it was covered by nothing. And you could not only see through, but also hear through. My longest stretch there was one night when we had 4 people in the front room waiting for Wolfe to show up. He was in the kitchen, chinning with Fritz. And we were expecting and hoping that one of them would sneak into the office to get something from a drawer of Wolfe's desk. And we wanted to know which one. That time I stood there at that hole more than 3 hours, and the door from the front room never opened. This time it was much less than 3 hours. Ori waited to open the door to the office until I was around the corner to the wing, so I saw his performance when they went in. As Goodwin, he was barely adequate introducing Wolfe to her, hemming it, I thought, and crossing to my desk and sitting, he was entirely out of character. No grace or flair at all. I would have to rehearse him before 6 o'clock came. I had a good view of him and Nora, but could get Wolfe in profile only by sticking my nose into the hole and pressing my forehead against the upper edge.
Wolfe. I'm sorry you had to wait, Miss Kent. It is Miss Kent.
Nora. Yes. I am employed by Mr. Otis Jarrell, his stenographer. I believe you know him.
Wolfe. There is no taboo on beliefs, or shouldn't be. The right to believe will be the last to go. Proceed.
Nora. You do know Mr. Jarrell?
Wolfe. My dear madam, I have rights too. For instance, the right to decline inquisition by a stranger. You are not here by appointment.
That was meant to cut. If it did, no blood showed. Nora. There wasn't time to make one. I had to see you at once. I had to ask you why you sent your confidential assistant, Archie Goodwin, to take a job with Mr. Jarrell as his secretary.
Wolfe. I wasn't aware that I had done so. Archie, did I send you to take a job as Mr. Jarrell's secretary?
Ori.
No, sir, not that I remember.
Nora. With no glance at Ori. He's not Archie Goodwin. I knew Archie Goodwin the minute I saw him, Monday afternoon. I keep a scrapbook, Mr. Wolfe, a personal scrapbook. Among the things I put in it are pictures of people who have done things that I admire. There are 3 pictures of you, 2 from newspapers and 1 from a magazine, put in at different times, and 1 of Archie Goodwin. It was in the Gazette last year when you caught that murderer. You remember, Patrick Deegan. I knew him the minute I saw him, and after I looked in my scrapbook, there was no question about it. Ori was looking straight at the pretty picture of the waterfall, at me, though he couldn't see me, with blood in his eye, and I couldn't blame him. He had been given to understand that the part was a cinch, that he wouldn't have to do or say anything to avert suspicion because she wouldn't have any. And there he was, a monkey. I couldn't blame him. Wolf, not visibly fazed, but also a monkey.
I am flattered, Miss Kent, to be in your scrapbook. No doubt Mr. Goodwin is also flattered, though he might challenge your taste in having three pictures of me and only one of him. It will save...
Nora, why did you send him there?
Wolf, if you please. It will save time and also breath to proceed on an assumption without prejudice. Obviously, you're convinced that Mr. Goodwin took a job as Mr. Gerald's secretary, and that I sent him. And it would be futile to try to talk you out of it. So we'll assume you're right. I don't concede it, but I'm willing to assume it for the sake of discussion. What about it?
Nora. I am right, you know it.
Wolf. No, you may have it as an assumption, but not as a fact. What difference does it make? Let's get on. Did Mr. Goodwin take the job under his own name?
Nora. Certainly not. You know he didn't. Mr. Gerald introduced him to me as Alan Green.
Wolf. Did you tell Mr. Gerald that that wasn't his real name? That you recognized him as Archie Goodwin?
Nora. No.
Wolf. Why not?
Nora. Because I wasn't sure what the situation was. I thought that Mr. Gerald might have hired you to do something, and he knew who Green was, but he didn't want me to know or anyone else. I thought in that case I had better keep it to myself. But now it's different. Now I think that someone else may have hired you, someone who wanted to know something about Mr. Gerald's affairs, and you arranged somehow for Goodwin to take that job, and Mr. Gerald doesn't know who he is.
Wolf. You didn't have to come to me to settle that. Ask Mr. Gerald. Have you?
Nora. No. I told you why. And then... There are reasons, Wolf said.
There often are. If none are at hand, we contrive some. A moment ago you said, but now it's different. What changed it?
Nora. You know what changed it. Murder. The murder of Jim Eber. Archie Goodwin has told you all about it.
Wolf. I'm willing to include that in the assumption. I think, madam, you had better tell me why you came here and what you want. Still, of course, on our assumption.
I said Monday afternoon that she didn't look her age, 47. She did now. Her gray eyes were just as sharp and competent, and she kept her shoulders just as straight, but she seemed to have creases and wrinkles I hadn't observed before. Of course, it could have been the light angle, or possibly it was looking through the waterfall.
Nora.
If we're assuming that I'm right, that man, indicating Ori, can't be Archie Goodwin. And I don't know who he is. I haven't got his picture in my scrapbook. I'll tell you why I came.
Wolf. That's reasonable, certainly. Archie, I'm afraid you'll have to leave us.
Poor Ori. As Ori Cather, he had been chased twice, and now he was chased as Archie Goodwin. His only hope now was to be cast as Nero Wolf. When he was out and the door shut, Nora spoke. All right, I'll tell you. Right after lunch today, I went on an errand, and when I got back, Mr. Gerald told me that the bullet that killed Jim Eber was a .38. That was all he told me, just that. But I knew why he told me. It was because his own gun is a .38. He has always kept it in a drawer of his desk. I saw it there Wednesday afternoon. But it wasn't there Thursday morning, yesterday, and it hasn't been there since. Mr. Gerald hasn't asked me about it. He hasn't mentioned it. I don't know.
Wolf. Haven't you mentioned it?
Ori was at my elbow.
Nora.
No. If I mentioned it, and he had taken it himself, He would think I was prying into matters that don't concern me. I don't know whether he took it himself or not. But yesterday afternoon, a man from Horland's protective agency delivered some pictures that must have been taken by the camera that works automatically when the door of the library is opened. The clock above the door said 6:16. The pictures showed the door opening and a rug coming in. Just the rug, flat, held up perpendicular, hanging straight down. Of course, there was someone behind it. Archie Goodwin looked at the pictures, and of course he has told you all about it.
Wolf. On our assumption, yes.
Nora. The camera must have taken them the day before at 6:16 Wednesday afternoon. At that hour I am always up in my room washing and changing, getting ready to go to the lounge for cocktails. So is everyone else, nearly always. So there it is, take it all together. On Monday, Archie Goodwin comes as the new secretary under another name. Thursday morning, Mr. Gerald's gun is gone. Thursday afternoon, the pictures come, taken at a time when I was up in my room alone. Friday morning, today, the news comes that Jim Eber has been murdered, shot. Also this morning, Archie Goodwin isn't there, and Mr. Gerald says he has sent him on a trip. And this afternoon, Mr. Gerald tells me that Jim was shot with a .38. The gray eyes were steady and cold. I had the feeling that if they aimed my way, they would see me right through the picture, though I knew they couldn't. Nora. I'm not frightened, Mr. Wolf. I don't scare easily. And I know you wouldn't deliberately conspire to have me accused of murder, and neither would Archie Goodwin. But all those things together, I wasn't going to just wait and see what happened. It wouldn't have helped any to say all this to Mr. Gerald. I know all about his business affairs, but this is his personal life, his family, and I don't count. I'd rather not have him know I came to you, but I don't really care. I've worked long enough anyhow. Was Archie Goodwin there because Mr. Gerald hired you, or was it someone else?
Wolf. Even granting the assumption, I can't tell you that.
Nora. I suppose not. But he's not there today, so you may be through. In the 22 years I have been with Mr. Gerald, I have had many opportunities, especially the past 10 years. And my net worth today, personally, is something over $1 million. I know you charge high fees, but I could afford it. I said I'm not frightened, and I'm not. But something is going to happen to somebody, I'm sure of that, and I don't want it to happen to me. I want you to see that it doesn't. I'll pay you a retainer, of course, whatever you say. I believe the phrase is to protect my interests.
Wolf. I'm sorry, Miss Kent, but I must decline.
Nora. Why?
Wolf. I've undertaken a job for Mr. Gerald. He has...
Nora. Then he did hire you. Then he knew it was Archie Goodwin.
Wolf. No, that remains only an assumption. He has engaged me to conduct a conference for him, on the telephone today. He feels that the situation calls for an experienced investigator, and at 6 o'clock, 3 hours from now, he will come here and bring 7 people with him. His family and a man named Brigham and you. That is, if you care to come. Evidently you are in no mood to trot when he whistles.
Nora. He phoned you today?
Wolf. Yes.
Nora. You were already working for him. You sent Archie Goodwin up there.
Wolf. You have a right, madam, to your beliefs, but I beg you not to be tiresome with them. If you join us at 6 o'clock, and I advise you to, you should know that the Mr. Goodwin who scurried from this room at your behest will be here, at his desk, and Alan Green, Mr. Gerald's secretary, will also be present. The others, the members of Mr. Gerald's family, unlike you, will probably be satisfied that those 2 men know who they are. Will you gain anything by raising the question?
Nora. No. I see, no. But I don't... Then Mr. Gerald doesn't know either?
Wolf.
Don't get tangled in your own assumption. If you wish to revise it after the conference, by all means do so. And now I ask you to reciprocate. I have an assumption, too. We have accepted yours as a basis for discussion. Now let us accept mine. Mine is that none of the people who will be present at the conference fired the shot that killed Mr. Eber. What do you think of it?
The gray eyes narrowed. Nora.
You can't expect me to discuss that. I am employed by Mr. Gerald.
Wolf.
Then we'll turn it around. We'll assume the contrary and take them in turn. Start with Mr. Gerald himself. He took his own gun with that hocus-pocus and shot Eber with it. What do you say to that?
Nora. I don't say anything. She stood up.
Nora.
I know you're a clever man, Mr. Wolf. That's why your picture is in my scrapbook. I may not be as clever as you are, but I'm not an utter fool.
She started off and halfway to the door turned. I'll be here at 6 o'clock if Mr. Gerald tells me to.
She went. I whispered to Ori,
"Go let her out, Archie."
He whispered back, "Let her out yourself, Alan."
The result was that she let herself out. When I heard the front door close, I left the wing and made it to the front in time to see her, through the one-way glass panel, going down the stoop. When she had reached the sidewalk safely, I went to the office. Wolf was forward in his chair, his palms on his desk. Ori was at my desk, in my chair, at ease. I stood and looked down at Wolf.
First, I said, "Who is whom?"
He grunted.
"Confound that woman. When you were introduced to her Monday afternoon, I suppose you were looking at her, and you saw no sign that she had recognized you?"
"No, sir. A woman who has it in her to collar $1 million knows how to hide her feelings. Besides, I thought it was only women under 30 who put my picture in scrapbooks."
"Then the program will be as scheduled?"
"Yes. Have you a reason for changing it?"
"No, sir. You're in for it."
"Please excuse me a minute." I pivoted to Ori. "You'll be me at 6 o'clock. I can't help that, but you're not me now." Down went my hands like twin snakes striking, and I had his ankles. With a healthy jerk, he was out of my chair, and I kept him coming and going until he was flat on his back on the rug 6 feet away. By the time he had bounced up, I was sitting. I may or may not know how to deal with a murderer, but I know how to handle an imposter.
Chapter 8.
I made a crack, I remember, about Susan's entrance in the lounge Monday evening, after everyone else was there, as to whether or not she had planned it that way. My own entrance in Wolf's office that Friday afternoon, after everyone else was there, was planned that way, all right. There were two reasons. First, I didn't want to have to chat with the first arrivals, whoever they would be, while waiting for the others. And second, I didn't want to see Ori being Archie Goodwin as he let them in and escorted them to the office. So at 5:40, leaving the furnishing of the refreshment table to Fritz and Ori, I left the house and went across the street to the tailor shop, from where there was a good view of our stoop. The first to show were Lois and Nora Kent and Roger Foote, in a taxi. Nora paid the hacky, which was only fair since she could afford it, and anyway she probably put it on the expense account. Transportation to and from a conference to discuss whether anyone present is a murderer is probably tax-deductible. The next customer was also in a taxi, Corey Brigham, alone. Then came Wyman and Susan in a yellow Jaguar with him driving. He had to go nearly to 10th Avenue to find a place to park, and they walked back. Then came a wait. It was 6:10 when a black Rolls-Royce town car rolled to the curb and Gerald and Trella got out. I hadn't grown impatient, having myself waited for Trella 25 minutes on Tuesday, bound for lunch at Rusterman's. As soon as they were inside, I crossed the street and pushed the button. Archie Goodwin let me in and steered me to the office. He was passable. He had followed instructions on seating. The bad thing about it was that I had four of them in profile and couldn't see the others' faces at all. But we couldn't very well give the secretary a seat of honor confronting the audience. Of course, Gerald had the red leather chair, and in the front row of yellow chairs were Lois, Trella, Wyman, and Susan, the family. Behind them were Alan Green, Roger Foote, Nora Kent, and Corey Brigham. At least I had Lois right in front of me. She wasn't as eye-catching from the back as from the front, but it was pleasant. When Wolf entered, he accepted Gerald's offer of a hand, got behind his desk, stood while Gerald pronounced our names, inclined his head an eighth of an inch, and sat.
Gerald spoke. "They all know that this is about Eber, and I've hired you, and that's all. I've told them it's a conference, a family conference, and it's off the record." "Then I should clarify it."
Wolf cleared his throat.
"If by off the record you mean that I am pledged to divulge nothing that is said, I must dissent. I'm not a lawyer and cannot receive a privileged communication. If you mean that this proceeding is confidential and none of it will be disclosed except under constraint of law, if it ever applies, that's correct."
"Don't shuffle, Wolf. I'm your client."
"Only if we understand each other."
Wolf's eyes went left to right and back again.
"Then that's understood. I believe none of you know about the disappearance of Mr. Gerald's gun. You have to know that. Since his secretary, Mr. Green, was present when its absence was discovered, I'll ask him to tell you. Mr. Green?"
I had known that would come, but not that he would pick on me first. Their heads were turned to me. Lois twisted clear around in her chair, and her face was only arm's length away. I reported. Not as I had reported to Wolf, no dialogue, but all the main action from the time Gerald had dashed into my room until we left the library. I had their faces. The face that left me first was Trella's. She turned it to her husband and protested.
"You might have told us, Otis."
Corey Brigham asked me, "Has the gun been found?" Then he went to Gerald, too.
"Has it?"
Wolf took over.
"No, it has not been found. It has not been looked for. In my opinion, Mr. Gerald should have had a search made at once, calling in the police if necessary. But it must be allowed that it was a difficult situation for him. By the way, Mr. Green, did you get the impression that Mr. Gerald suspected anyone in particular?"
I hoped I got him right. Since he had asked it, he wanted it answered. But he hadn't asked what Gerald had said, only if I had got an impression. I gave him what I thought he wanted.
"Yes, I did. I might have been wrong, but I had the feeling that he thought he knew who had taken it. It was..."
"God damn it," Gerald blurted. "You knew what I thought.
I didn't think I knew.
If it's out, let it come all the way out."
He aimed a finger at Susan.
"You took it."
Dead silence.
They didn't look at Susan. They looked at him, all except Roger Foote, next to me. He kept his eyes on Wolf, possibly deciding whether to place a bet on him. The silence was broken by Wyman. He didn't blurt. He merely said,
"That won't get you anywhere, Dad, not unless you've got proof. Have you got any?"
He turned, feeling Susan's hand on his arm, and told her,
"Take it easy, Sue."
He was adding something, but Wolf's voice drowned it.
"That point should be settled, Mr. Gerald. Do you have proof?"
"No, proof for you? No, I don't need any."
"Then you'd better confine your charge to the family circle. Broadcast, it would be actionable."
His head turned to the others.
"We'll ignore Mr. Gerald's specification of the culprit, since he has no proof. Ignoring that, this is the situation. When Mr. Gerald learned this afternoon that Mr. Eber had been killed with a gun of the same caliber as his, which had been taken from a drawer of his desk, he was concerned, and no wonder, since Eber had been in his employ 5 years, had lived in his house, had recently been discharged, had visited his house on Wednesday, the day the gun was taken,
and had been killed the next day. He decided to consult me. I told him that his position was precarious and possibly perilous, that his safest course was to report the disappearance of his gun, with all the circumstances, to the police, that with a murder investigation underway, it was sure to transpire eventually, unless the murderer was soon discovered elsewhere, and that now that I knew about it, I would myself have to report it for my own protection, if the possibility that his gun had been used became a probability. Obviously, the best way out would be to establish that it was not his gun that killed Eber, and that can easily be done.
How? Brigham demanded.
With an if, Mr. Brigham, or two of them. It can be established if it is true, and if the gun is available. Barring the servants, one of you took Mr. Gerald's gun. Surrender it. Tell me where to find it. I'll fire a bullet from it, and I'll arrange for that bullet to be compared with the one that killed Eber. That will settle it. If the markings on the bullets don't match, the gun is innocent and I have no information for the police. Per contra, if they do match, I must inform the police immediately and give them the gun, and all of you are in a pickle. He upturned both palms. It's that simple.
Gerald snapped at his daughter-in-law.
Where is it, Susan?
No, Wolf snapped back at him. That won't do.
You have admitted you have no proof.
I am conducting this conference at your request, and I won't have you bungling it. These people, including you, are jointly in jeopardy, at least of severe harassment, and I insist on making the appeal to them jointly.
His eyes went right and left.
I appeal to all of you. Mrs. Wyman Gerald?
Pause.
Mr. Wyman Gerald?
Pause.
Mrs. Otis Gerald?
Pause.
Miss Gerald?
Pause.
Mr. Green?
Pause.
Mr. Foote?
Pause.
Miss Kent?
Pause.
Mr. Brigham?
Lois twisted around in her chair to face me. He's good at remembering names, isn't he? She asked. Then she made two words, four syllables, with her lips, without sound. I am not an accomplished lip reader, but there was no mistaking that. The words were, Archie Goodwin. I was arranging my face to indicate that I hadn't caught it when Corey Brigham spoke. I don't quite see why I have been included. His well-trained smile was on display. It's an honor, naturally, to be considered in the Gerald family circle, but as a candidate for taking Gerald's gun, I'm afraid I don't qualify.
You were there, Mr. Brigham. Perhaps I haven't made it clear, or Mr. Green didn't. The photograph, taken automatically when the door opened, showed the clock above the door at 6:16. You were a dinner guest that evening, Wednesday, and you arrived shortly after 6 and were in the lounge.
I see. The smile stayed on. And I rushed back to the library and worked the great rug trick. How did I get in?
Presumably with a key. The door was intact.
I have no key to the library.
Wolf nodded.
Possession of a key to that room would be one of the many points to be explored in a laborious and prolonged inquiry, if it should come to that. Meanwhile, you cannot be slighted. You're all on equal terms if we ignore Mr. Gerald's specification without evidence, and I do.
Roger Foote's voice boomed suddenly, louder than necessary. I've got a question. There were little spots of color beneath the cheekbones of his big wide face. At least there was one on the side I could see. What about this new secretary, this Alan Green? We don't know anything about him. Anyway, I don't. Do you? Did he know Eber?
My pal. My pet panhandler.
I had lent the big bum $60, my money as far as he knew, and this was what I got for it. Of course, Peach Fuzz hadn't won. He added a footnote. He had a key to the library, didn't he?
Yes, Mr. Foote, he did, Wolf conceded.
I don't know much about him and may have to know more before this matter is settled.
One thing I do know, he says he was in his room alone at 6:15 Wednesday afternoon when the gun was taken. So was Mr. Gerald, by his account. Mr. Green has told you of Mr. Gerald's coming for him and what followed. Mr. Brigham was in the lounge. Where were you, Mr. Foote? Where was I when? I thought I had made it plain, at 6:15 Wednesday afternoon. I was on my way back from Jamaica, and I got home. No, that was yesterday, Thursday. I must have been in my room, shaving. I always shave around then.
You say must have been. Were you?
Yes.
Was anyone with you?
No. I'm not Louis XIV. I don't get an audience in to watch me shave.
Wolfe nodded. That's out of fashion.
His eyes went to Trella.
Mrs. Gerald, we might as well get this covered. Do you remember where you were at that hour on Wednesday?
I know where I am at that hour every day. Nearly every day, except weekends.
I could see one of her ears, but not her face.
I was in the studio looking at television. At 6:30, I went to the lounge.
You're sure you were there on Wednesday?
I certainly am.
What time did you go to the studio?
A little before 6:00. 5 or 10 minutes before.
You remained there continuously until 6:30?
Yes.
I believe the studio is on the main corridor. Did you see anyone passing by in either direction?
No, the door was closed. And what do you take me for? Would I tell you if I had?
I don't know, madam. But unless we find that gun, you may meet importunity that will make me a model of amenity by comparison.
His eyes went past Wyman to Susan.
Mrs. Gerald, if you please.
She replied at once, her voice down as usual, but firm and distinct.
I was in my room with my husband. We were there together from about 6:15 for about an hour. Then we went down to the lounge together.
You confirm that, Mr. Gerald?
I do. Wyman was emphatic.
You're sure it was Wednesday?
I am.
Wolfe's eyes went left and were apparently straight at me, but I was on a line with Lois, who was just in front.
Miss Gerald?
I think I'm it, she said. I don't know exactly where I was at 6:15. I was out and I got home about 6:00 and I wanted to ask my father something and went to the library, but the door was locked. Then I went to the kitchen to look for Mrs. Latham, but she wasn't there. And I found her in the dining room and asked her to iron a dress for me. I was tired and I started for the lounge to get a quick one, but I saw Mr. Brigham in there and I didn't feel like company. So I skipped it and went up to my room to change. If I had had a key to the library and if I had thought of the rug stunt, I might have gone there in between and got the gun, but I didn't. Anyway, I hate guns. I think the rug stunt was absolutely dreamy. She twisted around. Don't you, Alan? A marvelous girl. So playful. If I ever got her on a dance floor again, I'd walk on her toes. She twisted back again when Wolfe asked a question.
What time was it when you saw Mr. Brigham in the lounge? As near as you can make it.
She shook her head.
Not a chance. If it were someone I'm rather warm on, for instance, Mr. Green, I'd say it was exactly 6:16, and he would say he saw me looking in and he looked at his watch, and we'd both be out of it. But I'm not warm on Mr. Brigham, so I won't even try to guess.
This isn't a parlor game, Lois, her father snapped. This may be serious.
It already is, Dad. It sounds darn serious to me. You notice I told him all I could. Didn't I, Mr. Wolfe?
Yes, Miss Gerald. Thank you. Will you oblige us, Miss Kent?
I was wondering if Nora would rip it. Not that it would have been fatal, but if she had announced that the new secretary was Archie Goodwin, that Wolfe was a damn liar when he gave them to understand that he had had no finger in the Gerald pie until that afternoon, and that therefore they had better start the questions going the other way, it would have made things a little complicated.
She didn't. Speaking as a competent and loyal stenographer, she merely said,
On Wednesday, Mr. Gerald and I left the library together at 6 o'clock, as usual, locking the door. We took the elevator upstairs together and parted in the hall. I went to my room to wash and change and stayed there until 6:30, and then I went down to the lounge. Wolf leaned back, clasped his fingers at the highest point of his central mound, took in a bushel of air and let it out, and grumbled, "I may have gone about this wrong. Of course, one of you has lied." "You're damn right," Gerald said, "and I know which one." "If Susan lied," Roger objected, "so did Wyman. What about this Green?" "I would walk on his toes, too, someday when I could get around to it."
"It was a mistake," Wolf declared, "to get you all on record regarding your whereabouts at that hour. Now you are all committed, including the one who took the gun, and he will be more reluctant than ever to speak. It would be pointless to hammer at you now. Indeed, I doubt if hammering would have helped in any case. The time for hammering was Wednesday afternoon, the moment Mr. Gerald found that the gun was gone. Then there had been no murder, with its menace of an inexorable inquisition." He looked them over. "So here we are. You know how it stands. I said that I shall have to inform the police if the possibility that Mr. Gerald's gun was used to kill Mr. Eber becomes a probability. It is nearer a probability in my mind now than it was an hour ago. Now that all of you have denied taking the gun, for one of you did take it." His eyes went over them again. "When I speak to a man or a woman, I like to look at him. But I speak now to the one who took the gun. And I can't look at him because I don't know who he is. So, speaking to him, I close my eyes." He closed them. "If you know where the gun is, and it is innocent, all you have to do is let it reappear. You need not expose yourself, merely put it somewhere in sight, where it will soon be seen. If it does not appear soon, I shall be compelled to make one of two assumptions." He raised a finger, his eyes still closed. "One, that it is no longer in your possession and is not accessible. If it left your possession before Eber was killed, it may have been used to kill him, and the police will have to be informed. If it left your possession after he was killed, and you know it wasn't used to kill him, and, as I said, that can be demonstrated, you will then have to expose yourself, but that will be a trifle, since it will establish the innocence of the gun. I don't suppose Mr. Gerald will prosecute for theft." Another finger went up. "Two, my alternative assumption will be that you killed Eber. In that case, you certainly will not produce the gun, even if it is still available to you. And every hour that I delay telling the police what I know is a disservice to the law you and I live under." He opened his eyes. "There it is, ladies and gentlemen. As you see, it is exigent. There is nothing more to say at the moment. I shall await notice that the gun has been found. The sooner the better. The conference is ended, except for one of you. Mr. Foote has suggested that the record of the man who took Mr. Eber's place, Mr. Alan Green, should be looked into. And I agree. Mr. Green, you will please remain. For the rest of you, that is all for the present. I should apologize for a default in hospitality. That refreshment table is equipped, and I should have invited you. I do so now. Archie?" Ori, Archie Cather Goodwin, said, "I asked them, Mr. Wolf," and got up and headed for the table. Roger Foote was there as soon as he was, so the bourbon would get a ride. Thinking it might be expected that my nerves needed a bracer, since my record was going to be probed, I went and asked Mr. Goodwin for some scotch and water. The others had left their chairs, but apparently not for refreshment. Gerald and Trello were standing at Wolf's desk, conversing with him, and Corey Brigham stood behind them, kibitzing. Nora Kent stood at the end of the couch, sending her sharp gray eyes around. Seeing that Wyman and Susan were going, I caught Ori's eye, and he made for the hall to let them out.
I took a sip of refreshment, stepped over to Roger Foote, and told him, "Many thanks for the plug."
"Nothing personal. It just occurred to me. What do I know about you? Nothing. Neither does anybody else."
He went to the table and reached for the bourbon bottle. I had been considering whether I should tackle Lois or let bad enough alone, and was saved the trouble when she called to me and I went over to her, over by the big globe.
"We pretend we're looking at the globe," she said. "That's called covering. I just wanted to tell you that the minute I saw that character, when he let us in, I remembered. One thing I've got to ask. Does my father know who you are?"
She was pointing at Venezuela on the globe, and I was looking at her hand, which I knew was nice to hold to music. Obviously, there was no chance of bullying it. She knew. And there wasn't time to take Wolf's line with Nora and set it up as an assumption. So I turned the globe and pointed to Madagascar.
"Yes," I said, "he knows."
"Because," she said, "he may not be the flower of knighthood, but he's my father. And besides, he pays my bills. You wouldn't string me, would you?"
"I'd love to string you, but not on this. Your father knew I was Archie Goodwin when he took me to his place Monday afternoon. When he wants you and the others to know, I suppose he'll tell you."
"He never tells me anything." She pointed to Ceylon. "If there was anything I wanted to blackmail you for, this would be wonderful. But if I ever do yearn for anything from you, I would want it to pour out, just gush out from an uncontrollable passion. I wouldn't meet you halfway because that wouldn't be maidenly, but I wouldn't run. It's too bad.
You coming, Lois?"
It was Roger Foote with Nora beside him. Lois said the globe was the biggest one she had ever seen, and she hated to leave it. And Roger said he would buy her one. What with, I don't know. And they went. I stayed with the globe. Gerald and Trella were still with Wolf, but Corey Brigham had gone. Then they left too, ignoring me, and while Ori was in the hall seeing them out, I went and sat on one of the yellow chairs, the one Susan had occupied. I cringed. "Very well, sir," I said. "You want my record. I was born in the maternity ward of the Ohio State Penitentiary on Christmas Eve, 1865. After they branded me, I was taken..."
"Shut up."
"Yes, sir." I got up and went to my own chair as Ori appeared. "Do you want my opinion?"
"No."
"You're quite welcome. One will get you 20 that the gun will not be found." He grunted. I replied, "Lois has remembered who I am, and I had to tell her that her father knows. She won't spread it. One will get you 30 that the gun will not be found." He grunted. I replied, "To be practical about it, the only real question is how soon we call Kramer, and I'm involved in that as much as you are. More. One will get you 50 that the gun will not be found." He grunted. Chapter 9. At 9:30 Saturday morning, having breakfasted with Lois and Susan and Wyman, more or less because we hadn't synchronized, I made a tour of the lower floor of the duplex, all except the library and the kitchen. It wasn't a search. I didn't look under cushions or in drawers. Wolf's suggestion had been to put the gun at some spot where it would soon be seen, so I just covered the territory and used my eyes. I certainly didn't expect to see it, having offered odds of 50-1, and so wasn't disappointed. There was no good reason why I shouldn't have slept in my own bed Friday night, but Wolf had told Gerald, with Trella there, that he would send his secretary back to him as soon as he was through asking him about his past. I hadn't really minded, since even a 50-1 shot has been known to deliver, and if one of them sneaked the gun out into the open that very evening, it would be a pleasure to be the one to discover it, or even to be there when someone else discovered it. So I made a tour before I went up to bed. My second tour Saturday morning was more thorough, and when, having completed it, I entered the reception hall on my way to the front door, Steck was there. He spoke.
"Could I help you, sir? Were you looking for something?"
I regarded him. What if he was a loyal and devoted old retainer? What if he had been afraid his master was in a state of mind where he might plug somebody, and had pinched the gun to remove temptation? Should I take him up to my room for a confidential talk? Should I take him down to Wolf? It would make a horse laugh if we unloaded to Kramer, and our client and his family were put through the ringer, and it turned out that the gun had been under Steck's mattress all the time. I regarded him, decided it would have to be referred to a genius like Wolf, and told him that I was beyond help, I was just fidgety, but thanked him all the same. When he saw I was going out, he opened the door for me, trying not to look relieved. Whenever possible, I go out every morning, sometime between 9 and 11, when Wolf is up in the plant rooms, to loosen up my legs and get a lungful of exhaust fumes. But it wasn't just through force of habit that I was headed outdoors. An assistant district attorney, probably accompanied by a dick, was coming to see Gerald at 11 o'clock, to get more facts about James L. Eber, deceased, and Gerald and I had agreed that it was just as well for me to be off the premises. Walking the 30 blocks to the Gazette building, I dropped in to ask Lon Cohen if the Giants were going to move to San Francisco. I also asked him for the latest dope on the Eber murder, and he asked me who Wolf's client was. Neither of us got much satisfaction. As far as he knew, the cops were making a strenuous effort to turn up a lead and serve the cause of justice, and as far as I knew, Wolf was fresh out of clients, but if and when I had anything good enough for the front page, I would let him know. From there, having loosened up my legs, I took a taxi to 35th Street. Wolf had come down from the plant rooms and was at his desk, dictating to Ori at my desk. They took time out to greet me, which I appreciated, from two busy men with important matters to attend to, like writing to Lewis Hewitt to tell him that a cross of Cochleota noesliana with Odontoglossum armenvilliarens was going to bloom, and inviting him to come and look at it. Not having had my usual 40 minutes with the Morning Times at breakfast, I got it from the rack and went to the couch, and had finished the front page headlines and the sports page when the doorbell rang. The man seated at my desk should have answered it, but he was being told by Wolf how to spell a word which should have been no problem. So I went. One glance through the panel at a husky specimen in a gray suit, a pair of broad shoulders, and a big red face was sufficient. I went and put the chain bolt on, opened the door to the 2 inches allowed by the chain, and spoke through the crack. "Good morning. I haven't seen you for months. You're looking fine. Come on, Goodwin, open up." "I'd like to, but you know how it is. Mr. Wolf is engaged, teaching a man how to spell. What do I tell him?" "Tell him I want to know why he changed your name to Alan Green and got you a job as secretary to Otis Gerald." "I've been wondering about that myself. Make yourself comfortable while I go ask him. Of course, if he doesn't know, there's no point in your bothering to come in." Leaving the door open to the chain, not to be rude, I went to the office and crossed to Wolf's desk. "Sorry to interrupt, but Inspector Kramer wants to know why you changed my name to Alan Green and got me a job as secretary to Otis Gerald. Shall I tell him?" He scowled at me. "How did he find out? That Gerald girl?" "No, I don't know. If you have to blame it on a woman, take Nora Kent, but I doubt it." "Confound it. Bring him in." I returned to the front, removed the chain, and swung the door open. "He's delighted that you've come. So am I." He may not have caught the last 3 words as he had tossed his hat on the bench and was halfway down the hall. By the time I had closed the door and made it back to the office, he was at the red leather chair. Ori wasn't visible. He hadn't come to the hall, so Wolf must have sent him to the front room. That door was closed. I went to my chair and was myself again. Kramer, seated, was speaking. "Do you want me to repeat it, what I told Goodwin?" "That shouldn't be necessary." Wolf, having swiveled to face him, was civil but not soapy. "But I am curious, naturally, as to how you got the information. Has Mr. Goodwin been under surveillance?" "No, but a certain address on Fifth Avenue has been, since 8 o'clock this morning. When Goodwin was seen coming out at 9:45 and recognized, and it was learned from the man in the lobby that the man who had just gone out was named Alan Green, and he was Otis Gerald's secretary, and it was reported to me I wasn't just curious.
If I had just been curious, I would have had Sergeant Stebbins phone you. I've come myself.
I commend your zeal, Mr. Kramer, and it's pleasant to see you again, but I'm afraid my wits are a little dull this morning. You must bear with me. I didn't know that taking a job under an alias is an offense against society and therefore a proper subject for police inquiry. And by you? The head of the homicide squad? I ought to be able to bear with you. I've had enough practice. But by God, it's just about all I...
He stopped abruptly, got a cigar from a pocket, rolled it between his palms, stuck it in his mouth, and clamped his teeth on it. He never lit one. The mere sight of Wolf and the sound of his voice, with the memories they recalled, had stirred his blood, and it needed calming down. He took the cigar from his mouth.
"You're bad enough," he said, under control, "when you're not sarcastic. When you are, you're the hardest man to take in my jurisdiction. Do you know that a man named Eber was shot, murdered, in his apartment on 49th Street Thursday afternoon? Day before yesterday?
Yes, I know that.
Do you know that for 5 years he had been Otis Gerald's secretary and had recently been fired?
Yes, I know that too. Permit me to comment that this seems a little silly. I read newspapers.
Okay, but it's in the picture, and you want the picture. According to information received, Goodwin's first appearance at Gerald's place was on Monday afternoon, 3 days before Eber was killed. Gerald told the man in the lobby that his name was Alan Green and that he was going to live there. And he has been. Living there. His head jerked to me. That right, Goodwin?
Right, I admitted.
You've been there since Monday, under an assumed name as Gerald's secretary?
Right.
With time out for errands. I'm not there now. You're damn right you're not. You're not there now because you knew someone was coming from the DA's office to see Gerald and you didn't want to be around, right?
Fifth Amendment.
Nuts. That's for reds and racketeers, not for clowns like you.
He jerked back to Wolf, decided his blood needed calming again, stuck the cigar in his mouth and chewed on it. He removed it.
That's the picture, Wolf, he said. We've got no lead that's worth a damn on who killed Eber. Naturally, our best source on his background and his associates has been Gerald and the others at his place. Eber not only worked there, he lived there. We've got a lot of facts about him, but nothing with a motive for murder good enough to fasten on. We're just about ready to decide we're not going to get anywhere with Gerald and that bunch, and we'd better concentrate on other possibilities. And then this. Goodwin. Goodwin and you.
His eyes narrowed, then he realized that was the wrong attitude and opened them.
Now it's different. If a man like Otis Gerald hires you for something so important that you're even willing to get along without Goodwin so he can go and stay there under an assumed name, with a job as Gerald's secretary, and if the man who formerly had the job gets murdered 3 days later, do you expect me to believe there's no connection?
I'm not sure I follow you, Mr. Kramer. Connection between what?
Like hell you don't follow me. Between whatever Gerald hired you for and the murder.
Wolf nodded.
I assumed you meant that, but I am wary of assumptions. You should be too. You are assuming that Mr. Gerald hired me. Have you grounds for that? Isn't it possible that someone else hired me? And I imposed Mr. Goodwin on Mr. Gerald's household to get information for my client?
That settled it. Ever since I had opened the door a crack and got Kramer's message for Wolf, I had been thinking that Wolf would probably decide that the cat was too scratchy to hang on to, and would let Kramer take it. But not now. Gerald's gun would not be mentioned. The temptation to teach Kramer to be wary of assumptions had been irresistible. Kramer was staring.
By God, he said. Who's your client?
No, I'd never pry that out of you.
But you can tell me this. Was Eber your client?
No, sir.
Then is it Gerald or isn't it?
Is Gerald your client?
Wolf was having a picnic.
Mr. Kramer, I am aware that if I have information relevant to the crime you're investigating, I am bound to give it to you. But its relevance may be established not by your whim or conjecture, but by an acceptable process of reason. Since you don't know what information I have, and I do, you can't apply that process, and it must be left to me. My conclusion is that I have nothing to tell you. I have answered your one question that was clearly relevant, whether Mr. Eber was my client. You will, of course, ask Mr. Gerald if he is my client, telling him his secretary is my confidential assistant, Archie Goodwin. I can't prevent that. I'm sorry you gave yourself the trouble of coming, but your time hasn't been entirely wasted. You have learned that I wasn't working for Mr. Eber. Kramer looked at me, probably because, for one thing, if he had gone on looking at Wolf, he would have had to get his hands on him. And for another, there was the question whether I might possibly disagree with the conclusion Wolf had reached through an acceptable process of reason. I met his look with a friendly grin, which I hoped wouldn't strike him as sarcastic. He put the cigar in his mouth and closed his teeth on it, got up, risked another look at Wolf, not prolonged, turned, and tramped out. I stayed put long enough for him to make it down the hall, then went to see if he had been sore enough to try the old Finnegan on us. He hadn't. He was out, pulling the door shut as he went. As I stepped back into the office, Wolf snapped at me. "Get Mr. Gerald." "The assistant DA is probably still with him." "No matter, get him." I went to my desk, dialed, got Nora Kent, and told her that Mr. Wolf wished to speak to Mr. Gerald. She said he was engaged and would call back, and I said the sooner the better because it was urgent. Say 2 minutes. It wasn't much more than that before the ring came and Gerald was on and Wolf got at his phone. I stayed at mine. Gerald said he had gone to another phone because two men from the district attorney's office were with him, and Wolf asked, "Have they mentioned Mr. Goodwin or me?" "No, why should they?" "They might have. Inspector Kramer of the homicide squad was here and just left. The entrance to your address is under surveillance, and Mr. Goodwin was recognized when he came out this morning, and it has been learned that he has been there as your secretary since Monday, with Alan Green as his name. Mr. Goodwin told you what would happen if that were disclosed, and it has happened. I gave Mr. Kramer no information whatever except that Mr. Eber was not my client. Of course, you. Did you tell him what I hired you for?" "You're not listening. I said I gave him no information whatever. I didn't even tell him that you hired me, let alone what for. Of course, they'll be at you immediately since they know about Mr. Goodwin. I suggest that you reflect on the situation with care. Whatever you tell them, do not fail to inform me at once. If you admit that you hired me..." "What the hell? I've got to admit it. You say they know about Goodwin?" "So they do. But I mentioned to Mr. Kramer the possibility that someone else hired me to send Goodwin there to spy on you. Merely as a possibility. Please understand that I told him nothing." "I see."
Silence.
"I'll be damned."
Silence.
"I'll have to think it over and decide what to say."
"You will indeed. It will probably be best for you to tell them that you hired me on a personal and confidential matter and leave it at that. But on one point, between you and me, there must be no ambiguity. I am free to disclose what I know about your gun and its disappearance at any moment that I think is necessary or desirable. You understand that?"
"That's not the way you put it. You said you'd have to report it if the possibility that my gun was used to kill Eber became a probability."
"Yes, but the decision rests with me. I am risking embarrassment, and so is Mr. Goodwin. We don't want to lose our licenses."
"It would have been prudent to tell Mr. Kramer when he was here, but he provoked me."
He hung up and glared at me as if I had done the provoking. I hung up and glared back. "License my eye," I told him. "We're risking eating on the state of New York for 1 to 10 years with time off for good behavior."
"Do you challenge me?" he demanded.
You were present. You have a tongue, heaven knows. Would you have loosened it if I hadn't been here?
No, I admitted. He goes against the grain. He has bad manners. He lacks polish. Look at you for contrast. You are courteous, gracious, tactful, eager to please. What now? I left up there to be out of the way when company came, but now they're on to me. Do I go back? He said no, not until we heard further from Gerald, and I went to the front room to tell Ori to come and get on with the day's work, and then returned to the couch and the Times.